Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Reimagined's executive editor Matt Wadner talks to Janelle Woods, founder of Black Mothers Forum, a Phoenix, Arizona-based organization dedicated to erasing systemic inequities. The organization has partnered with the micro-school group Prenda to create 7 micro-schools in the Phoenix area with the ambition to expand to as many as 50. The two discuss what led Black Mothers Forum to micro-schools, what the experience looks like for children and parents, and how scaling up micro-schooling through public funding to make it available to as many people who want it can help address major issues of equity for low-income and minority families. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
Hello, and welcome to the Reimagine podcast. We're very happy today to have as our guest Janelle Wood, who is the president of the Black Mothers Forum here in Phoenix, Arizona, where I also live. Janelle, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you for having me, Matt. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. So I took a look at the Black Mothers Forum website, and I saw that you guys are involved in a variety of activities. You obviously have a lot of training in entrepreneurialism and in community advocacy. I saw a training for parents to, you know, to learn their rights about how to advocate for their children in the public school system. And, most interesting to me as an education nerd is the fact that you guys have taken the plunge into micro schools. So tell us about that. First of all, tell us just generally about the Black Mothers Forum. How old of an organization are you? What made you want to take the plunge into education?
Well, let me answer the first question. So Black Mothers Forum. We came into being about 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago. In August, we celebrated our 5th year anniversary. And what brought us together was to address our concerns about our Black sons and daughters being killed and shot by police while they were unarmed. And that was a great concern. It was going on across the nation in 2016. We saw a lot of that. And we recognized that Black mothers did not have a collective voice. We had not come together. And we needed to be able to articulate our pain in such a way where we would see the change that we so desired for our children. But that meant that we needed to get educated. And so what we did for our full first year was we sought out different experts in different arenas, like the education arena, police, public safety, criminal justice. We met with different experts, we met with mental health counselors, and we really got an understanding of what was going on in our community and how the systems work. And what we recognized was many of the systems were not working in a way that would provide a safe and supportive environment for our community. And so as mothers, we had to make a decision on what we would focus in on. And our purpose became about dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline because we recognized that particular pipeline was the cause for many of our young people having these negative interactions with police, with greater frequency, as well as being imprisoned or killed. And so we decided that we were going to look at what part of this pipeline did we need to focus in on first. And we recognized that the school end of things, the education end of things, is where our children were really being impacted the most with racial bullying, with being pushed out at a higher rate than others, and with them being disenfranchised from the educational process at an early age, just due to suspensions and these punitive consequences. And so we decided that we would learn all we could about the educational structure. So we had someone come out and talk to us about the Arizona Department of Education. We met with the Arizona School Board Association, understood how governing boards work. We got a feel for how the laws work, handbooks work. ASBA was very helpful in taking us through a template of the student handbooks to help us understand how things are supposed to run. Yeah. And what we started to recognize is that, okay, policy is saying one thing should be occurring, but in practice, something else is going on, right? So being able to delineate between those two things and being able to speak that. We also worked, ACLU at the time started an arm called Demand to Learn. And this particular arm did a lot of research on data that was showing disproportionality of disciplinary practices amongst the various ethnicities and different gender groups, which is the male and female, and taught us not only how to pull that data, but to interpret it and interpret it in such a way that we could use that data to inform our conversations and to start to inform the change that we were looking for. So once we were armed with that type of information, then we were able to develop some verbiage around what we wanted to see. We all collectively agreed that we were no longer going to tolerate or stand for these practices that were in place, and we were going to start to speak to them, but we're going to use data, the data that we got, to speak to it. So the schools could not deny that they were at a higher rate pushing out Black males, brown males, and our Indigenous males at a higher rate than anyone else. The females, the top ranking group, were our Black daughters. So we were like, all right, this has got to stop. So what do we need to do? So we focused in on how do we create safe and supportive learning environments for our children? Because we recognize when Black children are safe, all children are safe, because they'll put some things in place that will create these safety nets for our children. And we started to challenge different cases that came before us. And that's how we got into the advocacy work. So once we learned how to advocate, then we started to roll this program out to parents across the metro, Phoenix metro area. And parents were getting educated, but we could not educate them fast enough because we were starting to get a lot of complaints from parents. Once they found out what we were doing, we started getting referrals. So I had to develop a team of advocates that were assigned to the East Valley, the West Valley, South and Central, and then the North Valley, Scottsdale area. Yeah. And so we were overloaded with complaints. So we found ourselves, I found myself more often than not in meetings with principals, with school superintendents and governing board members, really fussing about how come your policy says this should have happened with this particular infraction, but you gave them the maximum penalty when this is their first infraction ever. Mm-hmm. Why did they get 9 days suspension and then expulsion or the threat of expulsion? What is that? They said it was disrespect. Our main one was disrespect and disruptive conduct. That's all subjective. Yeah. Where's the documentation to support that? So these are the things that we started doing, Matt. And so slowly but surely, in 2019, after doing this for 4 years, we realized we're going to have to do something different because this system is a mess. And we got a lot of work to do to create these spaces. But in the meantime, our children are still being pushed out. So what are we going to do to keep this group safe while we work on these structures and systems in the schools and these policies or these practices? Mm-hmm. And so our executive director, Deborah Colbert, she actually started a search for another way, an alternative way for us to help our students. And we looked at homeschooling, but we said, no, homeschooling won't work because most of our parents have to work and they need money. That's not going to work. Can't do that. We looked at Montessori schools. Those are nice, but some of those cost money. Parents can't afford that. So then this group homeschool, I start saying, well, is there a way we can do like a group homeschool, something like that, where we can group them and parents can come together and they can get paid somehow and do it. And she said, yeah, let's look for that. And that's when we come across Prenda. Mm-hmm. She came across Prenda and she actually had her grandchildren go through Prenda just as a test before. She didn't even tell me. I didn't know anything about it. She's just doing this test. Mm-hmm. I found out about Prenda in 2019, started looking at it and we started to look, perhaps these micro schools will be our answer, because we don't have the money to start a charter school. That'd take too long, but we need something immediately that we can get on the ground. Well, lo and behold, COVID hit.
Right.
What? And so here's the opportunity, right? We're like, COVID hits in 2020 and schools are all shut down. The kids are on virtual. Everyone's in disarray. Mm-hmm. And parents are crying out to get their children back in a social setting. And so we were like, well, why don't we do this in 2021? Let's just start these micro schools. Yep. And so we started them. And we started in South Phoenix because we knew that was an area where we had the greatest need for a smaller learning community. And our children were already traumatized pre-COVID, but now COVID exacerbated all of the traumas that they were facing. The educational achievement gaps, you know, wider, the virtual trauma that they experienced being virtual, you know why? Because many of our kids couldn't get on because they didn't have Wi-Fi. Many of our children couldn't get on because school only gave out one laptop per family. What if you have multiple kids in multiple grades with multiple teachers? How is that going to work?
Right.
So they didn't have access. They were getting docked for attendance. Truancy officers were being sent out to the homes to threaten the parents with jail. Right. So these are the things. So we decided to do that. And I promise you, we didn't mean to do that, Matthew, but it became something necessary for survival for our children. And so our parents and our community, they're actually looking at the micro schools, K through eighth grade, as a means of survival and a place where they can keep their children safe. And their child can now get caught up in school and get nurtured throughout the day. And the parent feels much better about where they're putting their child through the day. So that's where we're at.
We've had Kelly Smith from Prenda on this podcast. And for maybe some of our listeners who maybe are not familiar with Prenda, but is it the case that your students are enrolling in an online charter school and then you're going into your in-person pods? Is that how it works?
Right. Okay. So with Prenda was connected to Sequoia Choice. And yep. Sequoia became the charter that we're connected to. So they get their funding through Sequoia as a public charter. So that's why we're able to provide this service for free to the parent.
Your pods are how big in size are they generally?
So at minimum, 5 students creates a micro school, no more than 10, which is a manageable size. But we found out that with the Prenda model, Prenda said you only need one learning guide for 10 students, no more than 10 students. Because of the trauma that our children have faced, we need 2. We need a learning guide that helps us with behavior so that we can really work our children through those things, as well as a learning guide that's leading the academic side of things. And so we have 2 learning guides per space.
Wow. And so can you describe to our listeners just like, you know, because a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their head around this model, but, you know, can you describe to us like, so your students are, well, first of all, can you tell us about like, you know, sort of the student safety measures that you have in place? Like, you know, do you do background checks and that sort of thing?
So with the learning guides have to go through background checks. Everyone who's on site, even myself included, when I come on site, and I actually started the first 2 micro schools. So I was on site for 6 weeks. So I could actually understand our daily flow, work out the glitches, understand the operation side, the academic side, and the behavior side, and the parent side. So there's so many different sides that we had to understand. So I was there for 6 weeks. So we have to do IVP, fingerprint clearance cards. So everyone goes through those particular clearances. We also have to go through COVID protocol. We have to understand how to keep the space sanitized and clean. And if for some reason one of our children or their family tests COVID positive for COVID, then we shut down and we go into a virtual emergency setting. Right. And so we have all those procedures in place. And promise you, we did have to do that once in our first 2. We actually had to shut down. And so we learned, you know, getting a sanitation company to come in and thoroughly clean everything and have the children in a virtual setting, but still having the learning guides be very much visible for them throughout the day virtually. So our days started with 5-hour. We started out with 5-hour days. So we were doing 25 hours a week. And now we've moved to 30 hours a week just due to the academic lag. We're still trying to catch our children up. So we just, the parents asked us for that additional hour a day. So we now do 30 hours a week. Prenda only does 20 hours a week plus 5 hours bonus. We recognize our model had to be different because of the special needs of our children. Right. We do handle IEPs in 504 plans. Sequoia does have that. They have a special, their specialized team, their exceptional student services team. We work directly with them to make sure our children have the services they need that are coming in. So we are definitely, well, now well-versed in those areas. We have a teacher of record. Many people ask me, do you have any teachers on staff? Yes, we have teachers. We have former teachers that have come on board, and we have a teacher of record with Sequoia Choice. And that teacher of record is the one that oversees our learning guides. And they're the ones that facilitate the lesson planning each week. They have meetings each week. They're doing newsletters. I mean, just continues to keep the parents engaged and the students engaged. We do weekly surveys on parent feedback, as well as feedback from our students. You know, we want to make sure the students do feel safe and they do feel supported, and mm-hmm. where are areas that we can continue to improve. We do, our days typically start at 9. Children come in at 9. Some of them have breakfast. So some of our micro schools provide breakfast dependent on the student population. Some of our students need that. So we have meal prep. We have meal ladies with food handler cards that are on there. They're so cute. And they prepare breakfast for the children. And then they prepare hot lunches for the children. So they are taken care of. And we're always looking for people who want to provide meals. But in the meantime, we're taking care of that. So if somebody wants to help us with meals, plug in. Please, we need help in the East Valley.
is there testing? Are your students required to take standardized tests?
Yes, they just finished with the NWEA. They do benchmarking. We do our benchmarking tests were through iReady. So we did our diagnostics, but then we just finished our NWEA, and they have to take all the state standardized tests that everyone else does. The curriculum meets the Common Core standards as well as Arizona State standards. So everything is in line. We start off with community circles at 9 in the morning. And what a community circle is this the time for the children to check in. We kind of get a feel for how they're feeling that day. And this is an opportunity for them to take control of their learning for the day. So we give them an opportunity to take responsibility. How do we do that? Well, at the orientation, when we work with the parents initially, they have to go through something called a guide parent student meeting. And in that meeting, we get to set the goals for that child. That child gets to tell us, especially the older ones, as they get closer to 6th through 8th grade or 5th grade, they're able to kind of tell where they want to be. And they tell us, I want to be, if they're 5th grader, I want to be in 6th grade by the end of this year. Okay. Yep. Well, what steps and what things need to occur for you to get to meet that goal? So we start to put their plan in place. Then with that plan in place, now on a daily basis in the community circle, they get to tell us what part of their plan they're going to work today. And that's cool because it gives them ownership, something they haven't had before. Most children are in a traditional setting. They're told what they're going to do today. Right. And they may not feel like doing it that way today. So they're not going to do as well. But we find our children excel when they get a chance to choose what part of their goals they want to fulfill that particular day. And they do it well.
Right. Right? Yeah, this is really important. I remember seeing a parent survey that Prenda did. And I remember that they asked the students about their former school. Mm-hmm. And a large chunk of them said that they were hopelessly lost in their previous school. And another big chunk of them, almost as big or maybe even a little bit bigger, said, I was hopelessly bored at my previous school. Right. Right. You just described to us, I think, a process by which the individual student can sort of like, you know, whatever it is they need to work on, it's personalized to their needs. Is that fair?
That's fair. That's fair. And they're excited. You know, their parents, every parent from our first two micro schools that we had in January, every last one of them at our kindergarten. So we had a kindergarten graduation. Mm-hmm. And that was just awesome. We had kindergarten graduation and we had promotions. So we had one event where we did the graduations and promotions to the next grade. And we gave the parents an opportunity to speak at the end. So they gave remarks. And the parents said, every last one of them said, My child, I've never seen them so excited to go to school. They lost that after kindergarten.
Yeah.
Okay. They didn't want to go. Many of our students had stomach aches. They were throwing up. Parents had to pull them out of the bed. Now I hear parents say the child is up, dressed, they've had their breakfast, and they're waiting in the car. You're gonna make me late. And that is exciting. That's what we want. We want our children to be excited to learn. We want them to be lifelong learners. But we find that the traditional setting is extinguishing. They're just killing that desire for our children to learn. And we need lifelong learners because of all the complex issues they're going to face as they grow up. They need to want to learn. All of us should be lifelong learners. And so our children are excited to come to school. They have a smile on their face. They get challenged, right? They get a chance to do debates. They never got a chance to do a debate in their regular school setting. They get to do a skit because they feel like it. Like, I want to develop a skit to test out my English skills. I'm going to write a script. Okay, write the script.
You're right.
And this is awesome. And so we have just found innovative ways to keep these children engaged. And they did so well on their NWEA testing. Their scores were higher than they were the first semester. This semester, they're even higher. And we were really pleased to see that because now they know they've settled down. They know how to take a test now. They understand the material because they now know how to read. What we found, Matt, is when we did our diagnostic in, I want to say February of this year, the students coming in from traditional school, sixth grader, he was reading, his reading comprehension was at kindergarten level. Unacceptable for a 12-year-old. Unacceptable.
Yeah.
And in 4 months that we had him, just the first 4 months, his reading level came up 2 grades.
Yeah.
So we figured if we can get him a whole year, we can pretty much get him pretty much caught up.
Yeah.
Right? Where he needs us to be. And so, and he's doing much better. I just saw his pictures and I just saw his mother, and his mother told me he is doing so much better. He wants to be an entrepreneur. He wants to be a small business owner.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, well, small business owners have to know how to read and they have to understand what they're reading in order to grow their business. That's his incentive. I said, and they also have to be leaders. So I expect you to be a leader in your class. That's his incentive.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever told him that.
Right. That's awesome. I mean, I've heard that same sentiment. You described the kids eager to learn and they're eager to get to school. I mean, I've heard the same thing from other micro school leaders, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not just the kids, it's also the teachers.
Yes,
right?
They enjoy it. The learning guides, they said night and day. My learning guides that have worked in schools in the traditional setting, they said, Janelle, this is night and day. I am happy for the first time. This is the profession that I thought I was choosing the first time was to be a teacher or educator. Now I'm actually fulfilling that. And I've heard that repeatedly from my learning guides that have come in from the traditional setting.
Right. So you said that you take all the state tests. And so the charter school that the kids actually, you know, they enroll in, they will be held accountable for those scores will count against their accountability rating.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's something like just really funny that I observed, you know, as the COVID-19 pandemic unfolded and we had this national kind of move towards micro schools or pandemic pods, right? You know, basically someone in Silicon Valley decided to call them pandemic pods, instead of micro schools or whatever, right? But there was this really spirited backlash, right, in some of the media and opinion pages, you know, and people kind of said, well, this is going to like exacerbate achievement gaps and it's going to make things more inequitable. You know, and then when People Magazine had a celebrity DJ, you know, who's a multimillionaire, who, you know, he was on the front cover of People Magazine because he had opened this awesome pod in his guest house in Beverly Hills. I was like, whoa. Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh.
But the irony is that for pandemic pods, which are going to happen, which did happen without public funding around most of the country. The only way, in my view, to address the equity issues, which are very real,
right,
is to provide public funding, right? I mean, is to give people the tools they need to do this sort of education without a guest house in Beverly Hills, right? tell me what you think about that.
Oh, I do believe that's the way to go. We are all, me as a taxpayer, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we pay into public education. Our tax dollars go there. And so if my tax dollars are going there and other parents' tax dollars are going there, then by all means, whatever educational opportunity is available for my child, I want public dollars to pay for that, because that's something that the Arizona Constitution and the Constitution says I'm supposed to have anyway. My children are supposed to have a public education. They're guaranteed that in Arizona. And it doesn't say it has to be one certain way.
Right.
You know, it can come in different forms, but it's still publicly funded.
Right.
And I agree that it should be publicly funded. And I'm glad that we were able, you know, Prenda, you know, Kelly was able to find a way through his partnership with Sequoia and Sequoia's vision, Sequoia Charter's vision to open, to broaden their reach and their menu of options that they have to include micro schools as one of their options for their charter. And so this is the wave of the future. I don't believe we're going back.
Yeah.
Smaller is better, especially when you're dealing with a lot of traumatized young people. We're seeing it right now play out all across the nation. We just have all these shootings. Am I correct? We've had more fights in the schools than we've had in history. I've heard this has been very, very problematic for a lot of the schools. My goal at some point is to get to the high school level. We definitely need to break that down and make those more smaller learning communities for our high schoolers, because they too have gone through something. They're acting it out. And when you have 2,900 students on a campus, just doesn't work. And I've been in one meeting after the other with parents of fights. There's been a whole lot of fighting because these children need to be seen. They need to be heard. And they need that one-on-one attention to get them through some of the mental health challenges that they have faced over this season. Our teachers, let me talk about our teachers in the traditional setting. They are overwhelmed.
Yeah.
They are so overwhelmed. They don't know whether they're coming or going. They're just trying to survive themselves. And I don't think it's fair to them at all. And I told people, I am for all teachers. I have nothing against our teachers. Mm-hmm. I am for them. I wish that they would get it, that they need to demand smaller learning communities, that those schools need to break that up and give them a smaller learning community. They should really be demanding that, because it's not fair to them to have to deal with 37 children or 37 young bodies and all these hormones at once. In the midst of this, we're still in the pandemic.